Hello and welcome to the American Sheep Industry Association's Research Update Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Thorne. We're coming up on my favorite time of the sheep calendar year. Lambing season is upon or nearly upon most of us, and there always is excitement and a reinvigoration for the business with the arrival of a new crop of lambs. Now, whether it's in the shed, on range, or in the pasture, lambing season also is one of the busiest times of the year and can definitely be mentally and physically consuming. But as we make our preparations for the many births that will take place on our ranches and farms, this is also a good time for a reminder about the risks of zoonotic diseases that are transferable between sheep and humans. With the proper precautions and a sharp eye that can identify clinical signs early, many of these risks can be mitigated. Here with me today, I have Dr. Cindy Wolf, retired professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Minnesota's Vet School and a longtime sheep, goat, and cattle producer herself, to provide us with the latest advice on keeping our livestock and ourselves healthy. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Wolf.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is actually your second time being on the podcast, and I will say that your episode a couple of years back on management during lambing is honestly one of my all-time favorite research updates. I am really excited to have you back. Before we focus our discussion on zoonotic diseases, can you remind our listeners of your background and involvement in the U.S. sheep industry?
Sure. So I've been a veterinarian for quite a long time, and that's what brought me to the state of Minnesota, where I met my husband, who's a sheep and beef producer originally, and now we've added goats to our operation, mostly to eat the buckthorn that grows so well in Minnesota. But just as a bit of background, I worked at the University of Minnesota for 35 years, trying to help graduate more veterinarians who are interested in sheep and goats. That was one of my specialty areas. And now I'm home on the farm pretty much all the time, except when I'm still working with a few of my decades-long clients who are sheep, goat, and beef producers primarily.
Sure. So I want to ask you first to kind of kick things off. What exactly are zoonotic diseases, and what are the ways we can potentially contract them from animals?
Sure. So as I was preparing for this podcast, I found it really interesting. I had no idea that of the infectious diseases diagnosed in people, 6 out of every 10 infectious diseases are actually known as diseases that came from animals and got into humans. I think that's an incredibly high number. Yet on the other hand, I love animals, you love animals, and so many of the people around us love animals, not just farmers, but lots of the public as well. So it's not a scary thing. It's just good to be aware of. And also it was very interesting to look at what were the most common diseases that moved from animals into people. And luckily, there wasn't even a category for sheep and goats as they track those statistics, because there are other groups of animals that it was much more common, such as reptiles, like those little turtles. Dairy calves are sometimes guilty, and so forth. Poultry are often guilty. But like I say, sheep and goats weren't considered high risk at all.
Well, this leads me right into my next question. Maybe outside of just the context of the U.S. sheep industry and thinking global and with all classes of livestock, are zoonotic diseases becoming more common?
So I think because of my age, if you will, I've entered my 6th decade of life. I would say, yes, the statistics say they are more common, but I also want to be upfront and say, I think the tracking or surveillance that is done now and the enhanced diagnostic methods make it easier for us to really be able to put a label on things. And so probably because we're better at both the tracking and diagnostics, we're able to pinpoint names to diseases that we couldn't do, 60 years ago or so.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah. Now, we're going to discuss in this over this course of this podcast, mostly diseases that humans can contract from sheep or small ruminants. But I do want to ask you here at the front, are there concerns of passing diseases from humans to livestock?
So that does actually occur. It has a fancy term, which, you know, it's always hard to remember. So let's just call it reverse zoonotic disease transmission, like you say, from humans to animals. And the review paper that I was reading said this is really a hard thing to track. But the blame was put on, yes, some on livestock, but was also put on wildlife. And they gave some concrete examples. So it does occur, but I'd say it's an emerging field that we have more to learn about.
Sure, absolutely. Now, what sheep diseases that many of our listeners and the friends of this podcast might be familiar with or have heard of are there that are not zoonotic?
So as producers, we think about like lamb pneumonia, whether that's Pasteurella or a Mycoplasma, then those aren't going to be transmitted and infect humans. A lot of our foot or all of our foot diseases that I'm aware of, foot scald, foot rot, foot abscesses, again, those aren't going to infect people either. Another one that I was thinking about is blue tongue. You know, I don't live in a blue tongue area at the moment, probably will change. But again, there's not a lot of evidence that that's moved into people either.
Now, as I mentioned, throughout this episode, we can talk about several different diseases. But I think a good place to start is with potential pathogen transmission during lambing. Now, what are the diseases we are most concerned with during this time? And what are the symptoms in both sheep and humans?
Okay. So we have to think about probably our abortion diseases and not get real uptight about normal lambings. So as a producer, you know, we hope that we only see sort of what I'll call sporadic cases of abortion in a normal flock. So that's just, you know, where a lamb was malformed or maybe you got hit too hard going through a gate and we had some placental separation. But when we get into an abortion storm, we get over 2-3%, you know, we're hitting 5%. I've known flocks that'll hit 40% abortion. Then we got to think about things that can cause not abortion, just abortion in sheep, but we need to diagnose those because they can cause disease in people too. And unfortunately, they're hard to diagnose, but the two that most commonly come to mind would be chlamydia infection in sheep causing abortion and Campylobacter species causing abortion in sheep. The ones that are a lot less common to cause abortions and problems at lambing time in sheep, okay, are Salmonella. Might be a different scenario if we were talking about dairy cows. And also Q fever, which is not that common in sheep, but there have been certainly cases reported in goats and very, very occasionally in sheep. So we're pretty much focusing on bacterial issues that cause abortion storms. How would we diagnose those? So to be quite honest, as a producer, if we can't get the placenta, we might be wasting our money. So the placenta is what gets attacked by those bacteria and causes so much disease in the placenta that's why that you aborts, because the placenta can't support the fetus anymore. There are changes in the fetus as well that can be found more microscopically or molecularly, sometimes with the naked eye, but we're not always that lucky. So it's good to submit the fetus, but it's not of the same value to not submit both of them. And then I'm just going to share with you a little experience from this year and say that because we are a small industry, not every diagnostic lab is running those tests specific to sheep or sheep and goats. And so we want to be sure, and that's kind of where your veterinarian comes in, is it's great that we have a keen pathologist, but if we're sending it to a lab and that pathologist doesn't have that toolkit right there inside their own building, their veterinary diagnostic lab, then we really just should send direct to a lab that has that toolkit right in their own veterinary diagnostic lab. So, for example, we were experiencing some abortions in just one group of sheep, and it was a small group of pregnant animals, but it was occurring frequently enough, like a little bit like two a day for a while till we hit number eight, and then we submitted some. And our samples ended up needing to be sent to the lab down by you, Texas A&M. I also sent samples to us to another lab while I was waiting for results, because my samples went to a lab in my state, and then they sent it to Texas A&M because they didn't find anything. And I said, there's something going on. By then, we'd hit 10 abortions out of about 70 ewes. Long story short, the two out of the three labs ran tests right in-house, and we got a diagnosis, and we also got it much faster. Had we not done that, the first lab would have come up with no conclusion, and I wouldn't have had good feedback to know what management changes we needed to make. The positive outcome is we didn't end up with a disease that was zoonotic. And so I just bring that up because the world keeps changing in the way of which labs are focusing on which species, and it needs to be known among our industry that our veterinarians need to be partners in helping us know where these samples should go.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you that here in a few minutes, but if it's okay, I'm just going to jump right to that question. So you described that we need to get the placenta, and that's what we'll send off to the diagnostic lab. Can you elaborate just a little bit more on the steps that a producer should take to capture a good sample and properly package it up and get it sent off in a timely manner, just so that diagnostics can be performed successfully?
Sure. Really, really important. So I want to say quality in is quality out, right? And so, but the sheep don't always read that book. And so sometimes with abortions, we'll have placentas pretty damaged, and they don't always pass it as one big piece of placenta. So sometimes you just have a ewe that you know aborted. You picked up the fetus, you put it in two plastic bags, right? Because there's quality control in 2024 in the manufacture of anything isn't as good as it once was. So two bags, so we don't have any leakage. And then we pick up placenta, even if it's got, environmental contamination, whether that's dirt or straw or what have you, or you take it out of your guard dog's mouth, still submit placenta. Now, you'll have some sheep that don't pass that placenta, but they have a little bit of stuff hanging out. So as a producer, we put on gloves, we take a pair of scissors, and we hold on to the placenta that we can. Little gentle pressure, maybe it will come out, but if it doesn't, just cut some of that out and be sure you have what we call the button. So the raised area from the placenta and then the thinner, smoother part. And ideally have like three of those buttons and then more smoother part and put that in two plastic bags. If you already have formalin on hand, you could cut that and divide that up. But most producers aren't going to just have a jar of 10% formalin just hanging out on their farm. So then put them on ice packs, ideally not ice, because somehow that likes to leak somehow and make a soup. And the diagnostic lab, you will not be their favorite person for the next year. And put it in a styrofoam cooler that's in a cardboard box, and I send them out overnight. It's worth a few extra dollars to get it overnighted down to wherever it's going to go, and you're good. So if it's the weekend, just change your ice packs out. You don't want your samples to freeze. You just want them to be kept at refrigeration temperature. We absolutely can't control that the guard dogs like to do abortion cleanup. And so honestly, if you see your dog has some blood on it, you need to be, and you've got, ewes within a month of lambing, you've got to go see what that guard dog's up to, because it's up to no good in my world, but it's also a tip off that maybe that you just had the first abortion in your flock. And so the guard dogs might have to get locked up for a week just so you can get a good sample.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. Now, thinking back on the producer side of that scenario, why are the chances of contracting a zoonotic disease greater during this lambing or when we see abortion storms?
So of the things we talked about, usually there's going to be some of those bacteria in the placenta, maybe in the fetus, or maybe just on the surface from the birth fluids. And, you know, you can't see little bacteria or viruses that cause disease. And so the devil's in the details. So we want to be careful that we don't, you know, get it on where we accidentally have a runny nose and we wipe our nose with our hands. I'm sure we've all been guilty of that if we're honest with ourselves. And so I didn't go through vet school at a time where we always wore gloves when we worked with animals like veterinary students do now. But if a producer has sheep aborting, they'll just go ahead and invest in a $7 box of gloves and put them on when they start their day and take them off and throw them away, start with a new pair, you know, in between taking breaks of doing things with animals. But then your hands are going to be clean. And so most of it is accidentally consumed through our mouth or inhaled. While I should say, yeah, if you have an abortion storm, you should wear a mask. For some of us, that's kind of a challenge. Might actually make you touch your face, the skin on your face more. So that's for each individual to decide. Certainly, you can be pretty careful, and probably inhalation is a lower risk than actually getting some birth fluids or a smear of placenta accidentally in your mouth. Yeah. But the other thing that we need to be honest about is we're producers. And so we're outside working with our animals and we just want a quick run in and get a sandwich. And so it's sometimes hard to have the discipline, take your work boots off at the door, and also don't get too relaxed in your house when you got dirty blue jeans or a dirty shirt. And so honestly, if you've got a building that you're working through, lambing or kidding, keep extra clothes there. So if you had to help an animal or you got pretty covered in some of that birth slime, that you could just change your clothes. But I can remember a story about my mentor at the vet school, and he accidentally, he was on a farm and he came inside his house, and I don't know why he didn't take his shoes off right away, but he had a little crawling baby living in his house. It happened to be his son. And next thing you know, within a week, his son had broke with salmonella from doing normal things that little babies do, crawl around the floor, and somehow, you know, got mixed up with his dad's work boots. And none of us would ever mean to infect anybody. But that's a true story. And I imagine of our listeners, some people have stories like that.
Now, even kind of zooming out a little bit and not just thinking about during abortions or abortion storms, but I would imagine that many of the precautions you just mentioned are really critical anytime during lambing, even when, you know, it's going successful. Are there other precautions that producers should take to make sure that, you know, they're putting themselves at less risk, if possible?
Sure. So one thing I didn't mention was trying to do the pretty often hand washing. If COVID did nothing else to bring to our attention, is we need to sing or hum happy birthday, or there's a Beatles song that's all 20 seconds long, and wash our hands and get them really well lathered up and rinse them off. 20 seconds is a pretty long time. And if you watch people in airport bathrooms, most of them fail at that task. So, but let's be realistic and say, well, a lot of our farms and ranches, we don't have any running water right there where we're working with the sheep. I mean, when's the last time you saw a sink by the sheep chute, you know? And so, yes, it's something you could add and it would be wonderful. And it doesn't even have to be hot water. But if nothing else, and even though I'm kind of environmentally friendly, or I'm very environmentally friendly, it's a time you could buy some inexpensive baby wipes, get all the really thick stuff off your hands, and then use a 60% alcohol-based hand sanitizer. And it's easy to focus on the palms of your hands, but you got to focus on all your hand and then let it dry. And so luckily, human medicine was ahead of us, and they make some hand sanitizer that also has some moisturizer, so you don't have these hands where the skin's falling off. So that's one really good idea that we should do whether we're having an abortion storm or not. More of, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what do you, many of the diseases that you've described so far caused abortions are typically shed with reproductive fluids. Is there a risk to humans of contracting these pathogens that cause these diseases other times of the year when the sheep aren't necessarily lambing or mid-gestation?
Not so much, unless you're a small child. You know, small children are known to put things in their mouth that they shouldn't have. And so I'm a big believer of what we call farm school, where we have our children on the farm learning at an early age and learning to love our animals and be good problem solvers at an early age, but they need to be supervised and not playing in the sheep poop and wondering if that's a black jelly bean. So that's a time where, yeah, Campylobacter gets shed in sheep poop. And so we don't want somebody accidentally putting that in their mouth. So that's important. I guess I didn't bring up, and I really should, that because we can't see all the organisms that can cause disease in people, every pregnant sheep producer, goat producer, they need to make their own decision on what level of risk they want to take. So if it's a closed flock and the woman ends up being pregnant, does it mean she can't work with the sheep during pregnancy? That's for her to decide. But there's certainly things she can be more careful. Like that's a time where she might want to wear a mask. She might want to wear gloves. If sheep start aborting or goats start aborting, that might be a time where she gets to be better at something else other than working with the sheep and goats until she's delivered her own baby. Because there are cases, especially like chlamydia, getting into human women who are pregnant and causing serious disease to the unborn fetus. So it's good to have that discussion, and each person can make the decision. When should the ram go in? You know, that's the great thing about a human pregnancy versus a sheep pregnancy, is we could adjust when we breed the sheep because that woman's probably already pregnant, right? So, yeah,
that's a really good point. Okay, I want to, you know, for time's sake, maybe move on just a little bit. We can come back and visit these diseases if you'd like. But the next one that I want to ask about is CL, or Cassius lymphadenitis, because it is, you know, unfortunately pre-prevalent. Would you mind explaining the signs of CL in sheep and the risks associated with transmission to humans?
Sure. So CL is a bacterial disease caused by Carinibacterium pseudotuberculosis. And sheep get infected usually from coming in contact with it, either through like they just got sheared so their skin's not as intact, if you will. I don't mean they had a cut. I just mean the stretching of the skin makes it a little less or a little more permeable to bacterial challenges. Or they could inhale it. So again, I have to focus on some of the Australian work at shearing sheep that had CL in their lungs and were breathing the bacteria out, believe it or not, when they're crowded up, as is logical for shearing, so we can move them and catch them and shear them. We actually have spread during through the air at that time. As far as signs in sheep, we usually have abscesses forming in what we call superficial lymph nodes. So common places are under the jaw, behind the jaw, under the ear, ahead of the shoulder, ahead of the rear leg, sometimes the outer lymph node as well. And then we can have sheep that are infected with it deeper in their body, so a lymph node in their lung or actually in lung tissue, and all other internal lymph nodes are fair game as well to be infected. I learned that sheep usually had one or the other. They usually had the superficial or the internal form of infection. And unfortunately, since 1984, when I graduated, I've met some sheep that had both forms. So how about people? I have never seen a case in a human. I have read a few case reports, primarily people working in a slaughterhouse where we have cull ewes and rams going through, and there's a higher risk, especially as they pull the pluck out or pull the viscera out, and they accidentally cut an abscess and cut themselves. Again, you go to the sink, you wash well with water and soap, and probably of minimal risk, but that's where most of the cases have been reported in people. And so I would say if you're doing any kind of, as a human, if we're doing any kind of work with our pelts and we think there's an abscess there, that might not be your prime pelt, or a person be extremely careful peeling the abscess tissue away before it gets tanned, for example.
Sure, absolutely. Now, I tend to see conflicting reports on this, so I wanted to ask you something really quick, and hopefully you can clear it up for me. Is CL treatable in sheep?
In my experience, it's not treatable, and that animal will have a lifelong infection, and I've met my share of sheep and goats that I have known a long time, where we went in and we treated an abscess, or we surgically removed an abscess. And then we thought, 10 years went by and they were done with their productive life. Let's look at the rest of them, right? So we did a necropsy, and guess what? There were abscesses in that animal. So you have to think about the plumbing to the lymph node, if you will, called the lymphatics. So they're like vessels that supply the lymph node, and they get infected, and there's nothing you and I can give that sheep or goat in 2024. Maybe there will be in 2028, but that will clear those lymphatics from being infected. So if we knew that animal long enough, we'd find that it popped a second or third infection, no matter how we treated the first abscess.
Sure. Okay, another disease that isn't necessarily sheep specific that I would like to ask you about is Yoni's disease. What are the risks to humans from Yoni's infected ruminants?
Sure. So Yoni's disease basically makes it so the sheep can't absorb what it's eating. So what happens with the signs are that the sheep still keeps a pretty good appetite, but it just continually loses weight. It gets down, if it stays alive long enough, it gets down to a body condition score of 1, 1.5. Unlike cows, and this is where veterinarians need this reminder, but sheep producers know, these sheep and these goats, they don't get diarrhea. Cows with Yoni's disease get a screaming diarrhea. But the sheep and the goats, they don't get diarrhea until about 3 days before they're going to die. So where does it come from? It comes from other infected animals, or it can come from other infected ruminant species. And so it's a bacterial disease. And fortunately for us in the industry, there have been no strong links as far as sheep yonis infecting humans. So that's great, because humans do have a similar disease called Crohn's disease, where they, again, do have problems with absorbing nutrients, and humans have bad diarrhea, and it's a very challenging disease to live with. But luckily, the data is not strong that it comes from infected sheep. So that's important.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, what other diseases can sheep contract that pose a serious health risk to humans? I've brought up a couple, and we talked about some of the abortion diseases. I'm sure that I've left some off of my question list here, so I kind of wanted to just open the floor up to you and let you describe anything else that I might have forgotten here.
Sure. Well, one that we used to hear quite a bit about, maybe about 10 years ago, was what we nicknamed club lamb fungus. So not meaning to pick on these show lambs, but show lambs are meant to be, you know, sparkling clean, and often the club lamb type are sheared down to their skin very often. It's not harmful to the animal, but again, the skin has a little less of its strong immune system when we do that, lots of baths, lots of haircuts. And so they are more predisposed to those club lambs to getting a form of ringworm that we like to call club lamb fungus. And like any disease, I think, where we put pressure on it, it can get where it's an even stronger disease, if you will. So when humans get a case from their show lamb by accident, it often gets pretty aggressive, and that person might not just heal up with over-the-counter antifungals. They might have to go visit their dermatologist and get on a stronger oral antifungal or a stronger topical antifungal. And so my sense is, in fact, I got it once, and I'm not kidding you, the lesion or the sore affected on my arm, it got bigger every night. Every morning I'd wake up, I try not to be a paranoid or anxious person, but I'd be like, I think this got bigger. So finally I started measuring it. And when I proved to myself this was right, and all my, you know, attempted treatments didn't fix it, I went to my dermatologist, and he got a big kick out of it. You know, he's like, you've got the juicy kind. But anyway, he straightened me out. So I appreciated his knowledge and ability to help me with that problem. So I guess my message is, when lambs develop ringworm, it's really important to start treating them early. Usually we do use topicals, and everybody has their favorite topical treatment. So we won't talk about treatments per se. And I even know some lambs that go to a lot of shows that get a preventative antifungal rinse applied to them after each show. So in case they came in contact with the fungal spores from somebody else's lamb or somebody else's shearing equipment, because, you know, you dropped yours, or your blade all of a sudden wasn't working well for you, and you just, you know, borrowed your next county over's shears, you know, and nobody means to share infection. There's better ways to win and not win than that. But anyway, so those preventative approaches are often good too. Another one that has lots of different names, we call it sore mouth because it makes the lamb's mouth sore. Sometimes people call it ORF, but anyway, it's a parapox viral infection that is really good at staying alive in a scab. And so when lambs and kids get it, they can give it to their caregiver, their human. And so the human usually gets one spot on their hand. You know it's sore mouth because it's real painful, boil-looking thing with a nice red ring around it. And I'm not suggesting humans drain it, but when I tried to drain mine thinking that would take care of it, it didn't take care of my – that's how I knew it was sore mouth. Again, fewer labs have the equipment to make a solid diagnosis, but just talk to a sheep producer with gray hair, and they can tell you, yep, that's sore mouth. And so – right now, humans just have to manage through it, keep it dry, keep it free of a secondary bacterial infection. And then again, there's a lot of sheep producer treatments that we try on our sheep that I think do speed them up. But it happens. It doesn't mean you have the worst sheep or the unhealthiest sheep in the world. And unfortunately, we could put the scab with the virus from a healing lesion in an envelope, and 5 years later, that virus is still viable. So once it's around, it's around. But again, we can learn to manage it, because in our sheep flocks, we can start vaccinating and keep their immunity strong. Ideally, we can immunize or vaccinate them once and they'll stay immune. So we just need to do our breeding stock, our replacement breeding stock, you know, when we pick them, and then we should have some immunity unless we bring in a new strain. So if we bring in a new strain, then we need to add that to our vaccination. And I can always talk to somebody about that one-on-one. Yeah.
Sure.
what else we have out there? Well, one we don't talk about very much in the sheep world, but I think we want to be aware of it because it could start to become our problem, is this salmonella diarrhea. And another diarrheal disease is cryptosporidia, which is a common diarrheal disease in dairy calves. So I love dairy calves, but I'm going to assume that they all come into the farm infected. And so I'm not going to dump them around the sheep, especially not around lambing ewes, because I do not want to fight diarrhea in every lamb. And I don't want to get sick during lambing. I don't want to get sick at all, because you get about a 2-week duration of diarrhea, intestinal cramps. Basically, you're not able to operate at full speed. Your best friend is your bathroom for that time, and you will get over it as long as you don't let yourself get too dehydrated and have to go get some IV fluids at urgent care. And salmonella would look pretty similar. Might have a fever, a higher fever with salmonella, but because those are common enough in our larger ruminants, I want to just say, think about those as possibilities. And then going back to the crypto and the salmonella, they've both been identified as going from people into animals. So if someone's employed on your farm and they have some bad diarrhea, even though you're shorthanded, they'd be better off staying at home till they're starting to be better.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's a really important discussion point, thinking about other classes of livestock, because many of our listeners are not just sheep folks, but are exposed to lots of different livestock and animal species. And so, you know, I don't want to ask too much of you today, and I know you kind of dipped your toe into it already, but can you briefly highlight maybe any other zoonotic diseases that people can contract from farm animals, not just sheep?
Well, one that I was reading about, I subscribed to a very interesting listserv called ProMed, and they were just describing a case yesterday about a woman in another country walking down the road, reading something on her phone, and a stray dog ran up and bit her in the leg. And unfortunately for that woman, she died from rabies that dog gave her. And I think it's really important as producers that a lot of us have herding dogs. A lot of us have guard dogs. I'm going to recognize the cost of doing vaccines in our dogs. And so speaking about rabies, it's a virus. It's highly fatal to humans. Infected animals are totally unpredictable. Yes, we don't have a lot of dog rabies in this country, but we don't want to be there ever. And so I think it's important that when we put together our budget for our ranch or farm, that we put in there a dollar amount to keep our working dogs healthy. And so one piece of that is that every 3 years, they're going to need to get a rabies vaccine. By law, in all states, it has to be given by a veterinarian. I apologize up front that there's a substantial cost to all of us doing that. But because it's such a difficult disease to treat, I think it's a really important vaccine to keep up with. All your other working dog work, in large part, once you're knowledgeable, can be bought and done by you. In as far as preventative care, I'm not trying to circumvent my profession, but I'm just saying don't cut corners on that one. So have we had cases of rabies in the U.S.? Absolutely. But they tend to be from wildlife into humans. On the other hand, we all know it's an ever-changing world. And so those dogs that are working on your ranch or farm, they're valuable to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't have them. Your pet dogs have another value that's emotional. And so we have to remember that we do not want rabies presenting as a risk from our dogs. So that's a big one. I think it'd be easy to scare ourselves about a lot of other conditions, unless you have something specific in mind, Jake. But I just would say if all of a sudden things started being sick and dying on the farm or ranch, and that wasn't a usual scenario, that you need to reach out right away. So soon we're going to be talking about a bird virus that has jumped into a ruminant species. And that's scary to me because we don't know all the answers on how to control for that. And so let's talk a little bit about a general precaution that we could take. We have a bird virus called, nicknamed bird flu in this country. Most of us who have backyard poultry or even commercial poultry are low risk because we don't have a lot of wild birds migrating by us. So a huge risk factor would be, like in my state where we have a lot of lakes, is if we also had these, our farmed poultry next to where a lot of migrating birds pass through. And so the USDA can map that and tell you like what's the risk level for you. And if I was serious about backyard poultry and I wanted to protect my ruminant species from something that's going to emerge pretty soon, I would just have species separation. I'd keep my chickens, they're my laying hens. I'd keep them so they didn't make contact with my sheep and goats. And that is something that's kind of a one-time investment. You know, a lot of people love the idea of free-range birds, but we don't all have free-range sheep, right? A lot of us have herded range sheep. A lot of us have fenced range sheep. Those are called pastures. And so, honestly, if a person loves their backyard poultry and they want to still let them have a range, they could make sure that they had a portable way of moving their coop and their fencing. So they maybe would not have zero risk for contracting bird flu and maybe passing it along, but they'd have a lower risk because they were contained, but they were also contained away from your sheep and goats. So I make it sound easy, but because some bird flu viruses have also gotten into people in some Asian countries, I think we just have to be honest with ourselves. What level of risk will we want to take as diseases change over time?
Now, we have discussed quite a few diseases to this point, each with their own unique symptoms and ways that they affect humans and animals alike. And so you mentioned species separation, and you mentioned it with birds and farm poultry and also wild poultry or wild birds. And then also about you gave the example with dairy calves and, you know, newly introducing them to the farm. So I'm going to count species separation as one of your answers for this next question, but I'd like you to give your top five do's and your top five don'ts in regard to practices producers should or shouldn't take to limit the risks of contracting, you know, the conditions and diseases that we've described. These can be pretty much anything that you want: precautions, sanitation related, animal treatment, vaccination. I mostly want to our listeners to be able to have some advice that they can directly go home and put into practice in their own management systems.
Jake, I will apologize up front that I didn't count. So,
species separation can be in one, like okay. I said.
secondly, I'll just say something very common sense, which is keep the level of nutrition at a very reasonable level, including mineral, so your animals have a good immune system. I'll also say all of us like to buy new animals. But please, if you can, avoid dumping in your new animals while your other animals are pregnant. So have a plan. Know where you're going to put these new animals. Know that it's a lot safer to mix groups together after they've had their babies. And that it's never zero risk. Animals bring things in silently. But if you want to take the risk, don't do it during pregnancy. Okay, I'm up to three. I'm going to lump number four into the human barriers. So you'll have dedicated shoes that you wear on your own farm, dedicated shoes that you wear on other people's farm, or a way to disinfect in between. You're going to think about wearing gloves that can be thrown away and a new pair being put on. You're going to not be lazy. And when you've got dirty clothes, they can go, like if you're building a new house, the laundry room could very well be right next to the mudroom and a bathroom right there. So you can come in, take everything off, and put clean clothes on, especially if you have a lot of little children in your house. So those human barriers are pretty important. One thing I didn't mention, again, lots of common sense, but it's important to try not to eat around your animals, not to chew, not to do things that are going to get your hands up by your face while your hands are dirty. So we all get hungry. We have to have a way to have our hands be clean before they get up by our face. So everybody can come up with their own way of doing that. But most of us are not doing that now. And there's some really easy ways to do that. So it almost sounds like I'm putting a lab environment into a farm or a ranch. I'm just saying, if you never got sick from your animals, you just haven't ranched and farmed long enough. And so there's just some common sense things you could do. Okay, I don't know if I'm at 4 or 5. I guess lastly, I just want to say a precaution is good preventive medicine. So if things don't seem right on your place, reach out to someone who you respect, who's willing to think through and problem solve. And sometimes that's going to require us to spend a little money on diagnostics. But again, just to reiterate, get as good a quality samples as you can and research where you send them that they can be looking for our common sheep and goat diseases. And because sheep and goats are not small cows, so a lab can be really strong at cattle diseases, but not run in-house those sheep and goat, or even think through the same that someone who works with them every day does.
Yeah, that's great. Now, this is the Research Update podcast, but we often extend beyond the scope of just discussing research with sheep, as we have today. But with that said, I would like to ask you a bit about where maybe science is at in regard to zoonotic disease transmission, maybe in a very broad context. And I know this is probably a topic in and of itself, but what questions that you are aware of are trying to be answered by researchers related to this topic?
The answer for me in the sheep and goat world will be not enough. But I think it's really important. Let me bring up a couple things. There's was a goat nom study that came to some very valuable conclusions. We have just begun in January the 2024 sheep nom study. So with the nom study, there's information gleaned by putting together interviews and biologic sampling for various disease agents, and then some really super smart people who can synthesize what that information means. And so we, as an industry, we need to get louder. We need to let, for example, companies that can help make us better preventive tools know that we are a market that we want to be served. And so do we want better chlamydia vaccines? Do we want better Campylobacter vaccines? Absolutely. And so let's talk about Campylobacter as the example. When I first graduated, the main cause of Campylobacter abortions doesn't exist today. Now we have a new form of Campylobacter, newer, called Campylobacter jejuni. It is not sensitive to our common approach at controlling chlamydia and Campylobacter, which is to give the sheep and goats a specific antibiotic that we thought was good at controlling it. In fact, this Campylobacter is resistant to that particular drug. So is the answer in coming up with a new antibiotic? Sorry, that's a prayer that will not be answered for us. But the answer is to come up with some sort of better vaccine. And that's where we need the research, because vaccine technology has changed tremendously so that it could maybe be less expensive to make a good vaccine, but we also need our regulators to know that we need that vaccine. So that's kind of where I think the research is going, if you will. So I'm asking you all to not only help identify those new issues, but be an advocate. Be an advocate for our industry, because each one of our voices helps draw attention to getting better tools.
Yeah, that's great. Now, as we wrap up, what resources can our listeners go to or use to learn more about zoonotic diseases in sheep?
So I used to think the agency I'm going to share with you is having a lot of information on their website. I used to think they were potentially anti-agriculture. And as an agriculturalist, I think we have to be careful about that, because sometimes articles are published that are not really in our favor, right? But they have been putting out, and that agency that puts out some good educational materials and tends to be written in very clear ways to understand, is the Center for Disease Control, or the CDC. Like a lot of government agencies, there's a lot there to read. And so how do you pick and choose? And that's up to you. But maybe you pick, you know, whatever one your disease you're the most interested in. And so I came across, for example, a lot of information, but I thought it was really neat. One was called Animal Lovers and Zoonotic Diseases, Five Things to Know. And actually, that was an editorial, but I found that on that website. And I just thought, well, that's just such a good way to get someone's attention, right? Because if you raise animals, you are an animal lover. And again, you want to be at this for a long time, but all of us have the same goal of doing a good job with our animals and also staying healthy ourselves. So I think that's a real good place to go. And there's so much on the web. Where would you start and stop?
Right, exactly. Okay, final question. And you've already left us with many of these, but what is your take-home message to our audience today?
Jake, I struggled with that. And I think it's important that we're somewhat knowledgeable of that we're a relatively low-risk industry, but that there is no such thing as zero risk. So to be careful and be practical at the same time, and become knowledgeable enough that we don't get blamed for something that isn't really coming from our animals. And I'll just give you an example. Let's say it's really hot in some urban area, and there's kids in diapers playing in a fountain. And then there's an outbreak of a disease, and it gets blamed on animals. And it was actually just an infected child contaminated all that water, and other children were playing in there. And so the organism got aerosolized or swallowed and infected multiple children. So for us, our biggest risk is petting zoos, because sheep and goats are so darn cute. They're always at petting zoos. And sometimes there's disease outbreaks with petting zoos. So my suggestion to us as producers is, if we see something at a petting zoo that we don't think is as good as it should be, is to try to talk to the petting zoo operator, and hopefully be able to make progress in getting them to remove that animal from the petting zoo, so that we don't set ourselves up for where sheep and goats take the blame for an outbreak.
That's great. I really appreciate it. All right, Dr. Wolf, thanks so much for your time today. It was a pleasure. And as always, you are a wealth of knowledge. We really appreciate you coming back on the podcast.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you too for joining us. Maybe you are in the lambing barn as we speak, or in the pickup on the way there, or just aspire to have sheep one day in the future. Either way, we appreciate you keeping up with the Research Update podcast. Until next month, eat lamb, wear wool, and remember that the well-being of a flock includes a healthy shepherd too. Have a nice day.